Coming up today, human brains could soon send messages to machines as well as receive them thanks to carbon nanotubes. A Torquay hospital is using virtual reality to train doctors, and we find out why venomous snails and giant clams are taking over the Natural History Museum. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to sea snakes and pollution-eating bridges. I'm your host, Leah Clark, and I'm Associate Editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm Michael Rundle.
You might hear a new voice in there.
Hello, everybody.
This is Michael, our wonderful new editor. Tell us about yourself, Michael.
Well, I'm obviously enormously pleased to be part of Wired UK and the Wired UK podcast, part of the esteemed group who I've heard every week for so long. I've joined from HuffPost in the UK, where I was tech editor, and now just looking forward to learning all about sea snakes, venomous or otherwise.
I mean, yeah, did you get to write about that a lot at Huffington Post?
Well, a lot of cat videos, so okay. I'm missing that element of it.
Giant clams
to some extent
are going
to,
you know, comfort you.
They may be the next internet trend, so, you know, we can only hope.
Well, first there were cats, then there were goats, then there were giant clams.
It's harder to capture a sea snail, like, jumping off a table.
It is.
And, you know, falling into itself.
But imagine the cookery videos.
We can only pray that is content soon to be coming to YGK.
Well, we can only hope. Thank you, Michael. Welcome to your first ever podcast. May there be many hundreds in your future.
Thank you.
But let's get on with the news. So, Michael, you're beginning today with, you know, easy story that you've written. Just, you know, carbon nanotubes changing brains.
I thought I'd kick it off with something simple.
Easy.
Carbon nanotubes, you know, they're a fantastic material. We hear about them all the time in relation to everything from space elevators to advanced wearable technology. But I haven't heard so much about carbon nanotubes being used as electrodes, which are able to talk directly to and receive signals back from the brain. And that's kind of what we found out this week. So, you know, as we know, the brain is a squishy, complex ball of neurons. But the electrons we use to talk to it in treatments for Parkinson's disease and some forms of depression are still hard platinum electrodes.
It's really quite brutal when you picture it, you know, You see it here and read about these amazing experiments, but the actual nitty-gritty of it seems really brutal.
Especially because platinum electrodes break up to 20 to 30% of the time and can't actually be extracted in some cases after they've broken. So it can be very difficult. But obviously the point of this treatment is to direct pulses of light and electricity directly to the brain, almost to act as a pacemaker for people who are experiencing pain or tremors, so that you can train the brain to, you know, respond in a different way to reduce those symptoms. But the great thing about carbon nanotubes, and this is a new trial being tested at Rice University, is that they are far more flexible, they're softer, they're cheaper to make, but crucially, in the future, they may be also able to talk back to us. So it could lead to the development of devices to control these symptoms, which are responsive. So, you know, instead of just directing pulses at the brain constantly, regardless of what the brain is doing, we can listen and see how the brain is responding and adjust the treatment in real time, which is tremendously exciting.
So currently, the types of experiments you're talking about, there is no option. It's just kind of quite a simple process of instructing the brain and having no idea, having no reaction at all to how the brain's responding.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it's just that it's a slightly different process to learn how the brain is responding and to direct the pulses at the brain. So the good thing about this, I think, is you can do both at once. This is still some way off, obviously. I think all of the trials so far are animal trials. You know, they are looking at, you know, further tests and to start kind of moving towards human trials, although I think that's still, you know, a number of years off. But, you know, I think what's really exciting looking further ahead, though, is what this might mean for brain-to-machine interfaces. People have been searching for a very long time for effective ways to communicate with the brain and have that signal do something in the physical world, whether that's controlling an artificial limb to controlling actual machinery.
Or your robot helpers.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were such a megalomaniac. I've only known you a few days, so.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll close that door a little bit. I think a lot of people have watched that video, Braingate video, of a woman who is completely paralyzed, and thanks to a chip and some electrodes and a robotic arm, was mm-hmm. actually able to, she was actually able, with the electrodes synced up to the robotic arm, to control its movement and pull it towards herself and have a sip of drink. And it was a really cool video if you've seen it. I think it's from 2011. And they've done a ton of research since. Do you think, is this the type of thing that can be impacted?
Possibly. I mean, the great thing about Braingate is not only that it's like a dramatic piece of technology, it's that it actually exists. And,
yeah.
and you can see someone using it right now. And we're not there with carbon nanotubes and using that as a machine brain interface in the same way yet. But potentially it is exciting. It's less invasive, for one thing, to put carbon nanotube electrodes into the brain compared to putting an actual chip. As far as I understand it, that's still a fairly
yes,
major piece brutal. Of medical surgery. So, you know, in some ways it could be a more flexible and again, a cheaper way of achieving the same effect.
That's incredible.
In the shorter term, if it means more effective treatments for Parkinson's symptoms, that in itself, I think, is a really, really big thing. But we'll just have to kind of wait and see as to what the future holds and where the technology might go.
So exciting, because you think the brain is like one of the most vulnerable organs once you break through that hard shell. and we have poked around with it for centuries. And to be able to use, yeah, something like this is going to be revolutionary.
Yeah, it's always true with the brain. We still know so little yeah. about how it functions.
Now it can tell us.
And how to interface with it.
With
yeah,
the
but it's if only there was a USB port just above your ear, then it would be so much easier, wouldn't it?
I know.
A USB
Type-C,
maybe.
All this research. Just, we've got to figure it out so we can start controlling those robots. Anyway, if you want to know more about this, check out Michael's wonderful story online, search for carbon nanotubes. And if you can think of some wonderful machines you'd like to control in the future and how, whether you want to be an overlord like me or otherwise.
I'm not sure
right
we should
in.
Be encouraging those
No, please, fantasies. You know, we encourage all voices. We're open here. So, yeah, write in to podcast@wired.co.uk. What does photocatalytic concrete mean to you guys?
Well, not much right now, but I'm sure you're going to change all of that with your next story, Liat.
Yes, I am, Katie. A smooth transition. This is actually from a story James Templeton wrote on the website about pollution eating bridges cleaning up Barcelona. They're not really cleaning up Barcelona. That might be a bit misleading. They're kind of cleaning a bridge, or they will do when it's been deployed. This is a really cool project from some Spanish architects, BCQ, and it's based on this photocatalytic process, which is actually already used in certain types of air purifiers, that are being trialed to in indoor environments. They can even be used in factories and things like that to suck the bacteria out of the air. Very scientific terminology here. and now they are proposing integrating it into concrete on a bridge just in the northern outskirts of Barcelona. So, yeah, in very basic terms, it uses the sun's energy to break down the pollutants in the air around the bridge and turns it into oxygen and water. Great idea. So, you know, it's not exactly going to stop you all choking on fumes when you're walking through Barcelona, but one step at a time. If you break it down, we can thank some lovely, lovely substance called titanium dioxide, which is a catalyst that reacts to UV light. When the UV light hits it, electrons are released on the surface, and then they interact with water molecules in the air and can break up something called hydroxyl radicals, which are basically highly reactive hydroxide ions, if that means anything to you. These radicals then will attack the pollutants and break down the chemical bonds, and the result is some lovely oxygen, water, carbon dioxide, nitrate and sulfate. Then apparently when the rain comes, it just washes away the excess pollutants left over. So the point is, yes, lovely clean bridge, excellent advert for Barcelona, and you know, I think an advert for London to pick it up, because
yeah.
I mean, who gets more rain?
I'm almost picturing this bridge sort of gently breathing in and out. Although
you've really sucked up their promo.
I have. I totally have. But it's almost like, is it taken inspiration from sort of photosynthesis or that kind of thing? It seems like...
I'm going to say yes.
Yeah. It seems kind of cleaning the air, using sunlight.
Exactly.
You know, it's a real sort of...
And they're going to cover it with vegetation, so it really will look like...
So there will be some photosynthesis.
And there'll be cars bouncing around, so you might get the feeling like things are just like moving up and down.
Yeah.
I suppose that is the other side of it, though, is that another really good air purifier is trees.
Yeah.
So we can just plant more trees.
Exactly. But we need to plant an awful lot to counteract an urban environment, smelly atmosphere. But apparently quite a few people have done this already. Well, quite a few. More than I knew. Charles de Gaulle Airport has this system in place. In parts, and a church in Rome, apparently.
Oh, wow.
I mean, yeah, great. Vatican, rock on.
It does seem if there are two choices, non-pollution cleaning concrete and pollution cleaning concrete, just go for the pollution cleaning concrete.
I don't actually know how much more expensive it is, but I imagine it's not quite as
well. I think I heard the word titanium in what you were saying, so it's probably quite expensive.
Yeah, so maybe, I don't know, maybe we can, you know, argue for this with the upcoming election.
I think especially
any infrastructure plans,
especially in kind of those urban areas where you find it just isn't room for greenery and that kind of thing, and we've heard very recently about the terrible quality of the air just in the area that we work around, kind of Oxford Circus in central London, and you know, anything really that can relieve some of the sort of smog and the horrible pollution around here would be fantastic.
I think we need to knock down a lot of stuff and start again.
Yeah, well, they are knocking down stuff all around here, so let's hope when they rebuild it, it's with pollution cleaning concrete,
a plant covered building.
I think I also heard a spurious fact on the internet this week that in the last 3 years China has used more concrete than the US used in the 20th century.
Oh my goodness.
So there is a lot of concrete being poured around the world, so it seems like quite a good opportunity.
We'll get onto the Chinese embassy
and
about
something with it.
What they're doing with their concrete.
They have really bad pollution problems in the centre of their huge metropolises as well.
Well, yeah, horrendous. So, pretty horrendous. You think we're bad? We're pretty bad.
I think Paris was the worst in the world this week.
Briefly. Oh, this week?
Yeah. For about 3 hours, it was the worst polluted city in the world.
The stats that Katie was talking about was something ridiculous, like Oxford Street. I think on January 4th there was a newspaper article saying Oxford Street had already breached its quota, its pollution quota for the day, because we live in a world where you have pollution quotas.
Again, very glad to be here from now on. I didn't realise it would have such an impact on my lungs.
Yeah.
Well, here's your long life, Michael. So Katie, you had quite an adventure this week.
I did, yes.
You just... swam with clams and killer snails, and we didn't swim with them, did you?
No, but I did get to see some at a new exhibition at the Natural History Museum in London.
One of my favourite museums.
It is. It's not only an excellent museum, but it's a beautiful building as well. If you are ever in London and, you know, have a few hours spare, then it's one of those things I definitely recommend going to see. And I also recommend the new exhibition, which is called Coral Reefs: Secret Cities of the Sea. It contains loads of really cool stuff. There are about 250 different specimens altogether, including fish, marine invertebrates, sea turtles, sea snakes, octopuses, giant clams, and these beautifully intricate shells that belong to highly venomous snails. And there's also some really huge sort of fish there. There's a massive ray and a 3 meter long giant grouper. So, you know, there's loads of stuff that the Natural History Museum has, these massive archives, and you know, the majority of the stuff that they have there is not usually even on display because they've got so much of it.
That always boggles my mind. I had a friend once who was studying I think she's studying geography, and she got to see behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum for some reason, and they have hangars, the huge hangars out in West London somewhere, where they just have like giant
just
elephants and whales
on,
all this amazing stuff just hanging there, and she couldn't believe it. So it's amazing that they could kind of
I know somewhere behind the scenes as well, they've got a giant squid which is being held in a huge tank, and that actually isn't on display, but
Well, you never know when you'll need one of those.
Yes,
so it's good to have it on reserve.
But particularly exciting among the Natural History Museum's collection are some specimens that were actually collected by Darwin himself. And I know that a lot of the specimens, so they've got like butterflies that Darwin has pinned into these display cases himself. But in the exhibition, they've got some coral that he collected while he was conducting some of his earliest work. Because before he became famous for his evolutionary theory, and he was originally interested in marine invertebrates, and you know he did a lot of research in this area. So there are some, you can, if you go to this exhibition, you can see some of the corals that Darwin collected. There's also a really strong conservation message that's going on throughout the exhibition. And Natural History Museum's partnered with the Catlin Sea View Survey, which the aim of this is they're doing a worldwide survey of all the reefs that are out there and trying to make all of the data that they collect available to researchers around the world in order to try and preserve the reefs for longer.
So, all of them?
Yes. They're kind of gradually going around the world. I think there's something crazy like 375,000 square kilometres of reef throughout the world. And they're, you know, slowly trying to get around all of it. And I actually talked to the chief scientist of the Catlin Sea View Survey at the Natural History Museum yesterday, and he was telling me all sorts of exciting things about the technology that they use for conservation. So one of the displays in the exhibition shows some mesophotic corals, which are corals that are found on reefs that are way below the normal depth. So you can't dive down to them. They're below 30 metres, like down to 150 metres, where the light is really dim. But there are corals that are still growing down there. And
I wonder what they look... I want to know what they look like.
There are some in the exhibition.
You know the fish that they find that live at the deepest depths, and they look like monsters.
Yeah.
Does the coral go that way?
Well, there is coral down there which is similarly weird to some of the creatures that you can see down there too. But they're trying to they're using remotely operated vehicles to try and get down to those depths and use the information that they're learning from the coral down there, and they're bringing some samples back up to the surface and that kind of thing to learn about how they might preserve the reefs that are closer to the surface that we're seeing a lot of damage, you know, from climate issues and storms and all the rest of it. So the other technology that the CV survey has been using is a specially designed camera that was the same camera that's been used to open up the Great Barrier Reef and some other underwater environments on Google Street View. And you can actually, in the exhibition, you can go, if you want to go and have a look at this, it's available online on Google Street View now. But in the exhibition, they've got kind of these booths with joysticks in them where you can go navigate around these underwater environments too. And the survey's actually taken 800,000 images with this camera across 22 countries so far.
Wow.
And stitched them all together and put them online.
I was just going to say, what is it, 72, whatever figure you said, of reef? They've got a long way to go.
Yeah, they have, yeah. There are all these 360-degree images that you can go and explore. So I definitely recommend going and having a look at that. And there's also, it's not just sort of preserved dead things that are in this exhibition. They do actually have a 4-ton aquarium there with, I think, 26 species of coral and some really cool fish.
The best of what, real live living fish.
Yes, living fish.
If you're
into your aquariums, which I personally am, find them very relaxing. there's also that there. So yeah, go down and take a look.
So it's open now, Katie, is it?
So it actually opens on the 27th of March, and it runs till the 13th of September. Adult tickets start at £9 for the exhibition, and children's tickets start at £4. And I probably, knowing the Natural History Museum, I would recommend, if you want to go down, that you pre-book, especially at the weekends, because these exhibitions do tend to get quite busy.
So we write a lot about virtual reality, obviously. Very exciting times for virtual reality. And Katie saw some really cool demos.
I did.
At Mobile World Congress. But this week I spoke with a PhD student at Torbay Hospital in Torquay, of all places, who's bringing VR to the NHS. Excellent man he is. This guy, Nick Perez, it has been working on this project since only last November, but he's envisaging, hopefully, if they get funding, it's implemented into training from autumn. Now, I know there's a bunch of VR programs in healthcare around the world. I've written about a few of them, researching pain management, PTSD, even surgical training demos have been set up. But it's pretty cool that the NHS is now actually exploring this in a really practical sense. This isn't that sexy for VR, but it's a really good project, I think, and shows how you can just do something fairly simple and quickly, but with great results. So basically, it's called Patient VR, and it's focused really on the patient's experience. It's designed to put doctors, nurses, other practitioners in the patient's shoes so that they understand what it's like to be sitting in an ambulance and the driver's shouting down, you know, the phone about your condition and you don't know what's going on, feeling that kind of claustrophobia and nerves, and then actually sitting down with a doctor and then heading into the operating theatre. And the kinds of things that they filmed are really, they're really subtle scenarios that they, you know, it's going to sound, again, not very sexy.
So it's like everyday situations that you might experience when you're a patient.
Exactly, yeah. So the demo that they've begun with is a patient experiencing chest pains, and it takes them from the ambulance to A&E to the theatre. And really minute things that you wouldn't even think about, like apparently they have, when they're in the operating theatre, one of the bulbs is blown and you can see that it's not working.
Right.
And really subtle things like that, that day to day you're working in a busy hospital, funding cuts, so you're probably not that worried. You're worried about helping your patient, doing the right thing, and all these little things can kind of add up to have a very nervous, anxious person on your hands.
Is it right that one of the doctors that you spoke to actually confronted himself in one of the demos?
Yeah, in a really creepy twist of events. This gentleman was actually the doctor in the demo film, and then he tested it out later as a patient, which he described to me as freaky, quote unquote. He did not. So he not only got to, you know, experience life as a patient, which of course you always, many of us have experienced, but you probably aren't really sitting there thinking, analysing your experience in the way that they want you to here. But he got to see what his mannerisms were like, things that he, you know, just, you wouldn't even think about, your day-to-day mannerisms. He was saying, obviously, paramount in our profession is putting the patient's feelings first and their vulnerabilities and being empathetic and everything else. But you don't realise sometimes how you can slip away from this when you see people coming through your doors every day with life-threatening conditions. To you, it starts to feel, well, it's normalised, obviously.
I suppose if you're a doctor, not, you're also used to being in that hospital environment. Like, if you're a patient coming into hospital, I mean, I know that some patients kind of come in and out all the time, but a lot of patients that come in through A&E and that kind of thing, they haven't necessarily had that experience before. Maybe they've been to hospitals to visit people, or they might have gone in with something minor. But,
yeah,
you know,
a cut finger.
Yeah.
So we're talking about serious situations sometimes, yeah, that, yeah, you can feel very vulnerable.
So I suppose it's probably putting them in that situation where they're forced to kind of reassess the environment that they're entering as somewhere new and somewhere foreign and a bit alien to them as well.
Absolutely. I think one of the guys I spoke to was talking about, you know, himself looming over the patients. Sounds, I'm sure he wasn't looming. I'm sure he was patting them on the back and being very friendly. But you don't notice all these things that add up. Another one was, you know, hearing a conversation just in earshot. You can't see the doctors, but you can hear that your doctor is conferring with someone else about you, but you can't really tell what's going on or what they're talking about. And that can feel, you know, your lives are in their hands, obviously, but you want to feel like there's a communication there and that they change their bulbs.
Yeah.
If they're not changing their bulbs, what else aren't they changing?
The patients will be in the dark.
Oh, Katie, that was excellent. Yes.
That was good punning.
Oh, thanks. I'm usually terrible at punning.
So, I mean, I think it's, a really cool thing. As I keep saying, not super sexy, but really practical. Mm. This is something they do a lot in medical simulations to train physicians and young doctors. But Nick Perez, who set it up, said the reaction from doctors who've, you know, been working for decades was great as well. Mm. They obviously have to keep up with training and the latest medical literature, but also to step back and, you know, remind yourself what you're really doing there. The doctor that I spoke to, who was treated by himself as a doctor, Todd Guest, said that it's a really powerful reminder of why we're doing the job that we do. We're here to make them feel better, not just to treat them. And that's an all-encompassing thing. And this works as a really good reminder. So hopefully it will work out. The technical side is super basic. They basically have a dual rig GoPro on their heads when they're filming it. They have a seven GoPro rig to do the 360 environment for the operating theatre and the ambulance. So when you wear the DK2 Oculus Rift, which is what they're using currently, you don't really have any agency, but you can look around and up and down and zoom in and out. So, you know, that's the state they're currently in, and they're also trialing a whole bunch of other scenarios. Things like giving a patient bad news, obviously a big one, but he's also working on time lapses of places like operating theatres to look at waste management and how people move around, if they're doing it in the most efficient way, if they're chucking equipment away too much, whatever it is. So kind of really interesting behind the scenes stuff. Mm. I think it's interesting. It's no like horror VR experience like Katie got to see MWC, but I think it's a kind of nice practical thing that shows how you can quickly get from A to B without definitely too much fuss.
It sounds like it won't be too expensive either for the NHS to implement in training, which will inevitably be a good thing.
Almost certainly. Are there any plans to roll it out more widely, or is that
beyond the hospital? Not yet, but as it stands now, they're very hopeful. They were loath to give me a date, but I think if funding is in place, you know, by the end of summer, early autumn, they should be rolling it out in Torbay Hospital as part of all the normal clinical training they give to doctors, so all the regular training. And beyond that, I would have thought, you know, once that's a test case that's proven, why not do it everywhere? That's all this week, but still to come, we talk about Facebook's exciting developers conference.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So, Katie, you were sat at your desk diligently watching Mark Zuckerberg's conference.
I was. So it's the Facebook Developers Conference in San Francisco, the F8 conference, as we speak right now. And I've seen Mark Zuckerberg talk quite a lot this year, actually, because I saw him speak at MWC as well, where he announced absolutely nothing.
That was not a thrilling speech.
No, it was not. It was not. And the main takeaway that I have from watching Mark Zuckerberg speak is that he likes to say folks a lot. He's like,
it really grounds him with the people.
Is this not the speech where at least five people definitely fell asleep and were photographed falling asleep on social media in a way that was quite mean for people to then tweet?
And actually, there were people that were leaving as well during the speech. And it was really annoying because you had to queue for hours to get in. And I, as a journalist, I kind of, you know, it's my duty to kind of go along and make sure that if he says anything interesting that I hear it. So all these people have been queuing up for hours and then just fell asleep or walked out.
This week was more exciting, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So yesterday, Facebook announced a feature called On This Day, which actually might remind you of an existing third-party Facebook feature called Time Hop. Now, what it's doing is it's actually making it easier for you to relive birthdays, graduations, holidays of years gone by, by allowing you to see what you were doing on any exact day, but sort of several years back, so a year ago, 2 years ago, etc. Now, this is just the latest experiment in nostalgia from Facebook.
Yes, the last one didn't go down like, well, it went down kind of in a ball of flames, I'd say.
Well, I think
okay. I know you're referring have an opinion to
the well. This is the year in review videos that they did at the end of last year,
which were really cringe.
Well, I think they were well intentioned, but probably not too nuanced when it comes to people who maybe didn't have the best year. And there were lots of cases online of people who had had very tragic things happen to them, which were then reviewed with happy, sparkly music through the videos. And Facebook apologized and said that it would be working harder to provide better videos next year.
But do you know what that will mean? That will mean that more nuance means they're just going to stalk us more. And it will be even creepier when you get an alert going, "We're so sorry to hear about X, Y, and Z. Let's make a video to make you feel better." But I'm not sure what's worse.
I think it's just a question of how much nostalgia do you need in your lives.
None.
You
know? Let's look ahead. We're about the future. What?
Well, this is the thing. Everything that happened, you know, earlier this year or years past on Facebook, I was younger then.
Yeah.
I looked better then.
I was younger. I was slimmer. I was.
You know, all my future was ahead of me, and now I'll just be confronted with all of my
your crushed dreams.
Yeah, my misery basically on a daily basis.
That's
now.
How I feel about life. I'm a big regretter. So yeah, I don't like being. Yeah, no.
I have enough like nostalgia in my life as it is, without having like Facebook's rose-tinted, tinkly music view like forced upon me as well, on top of, you know, all the things that I already think about. And you know, I sometimes occasionally go back and look for something on Facebook, like maybe a photo that I remember of like me and a friend at, you know, or for a specific purpose, but generally I don't really care. Like I've always seen social media, probably Twitter more than Facebook, but Facebook too, to a certain extent, is more of a real-time medium. You know, you only scroll down a certain amount before you stop.
You're keeping up to date, what's going on, what do I need to know, blah, blah, blah. It just reminds me what a loser I am as well, because it was mainly pictures of me and my husband, and I thought, do I not have any friends? the only photos I take on holiday.
This is the thing, I think it's kind of similar to when Apple release, you know, a new Photos app. Like, it's the kind of thing that really only works best if you're in California, and like one day you're surfing, and then the next day you're climbing, you know, a mountain in Yosemite National Park,
and then you're having brunch in San Francisco.
Yeah, and then you're pretty much surfing until the end of the week. And
yeah, you know, the sun is always shining.
Saved a few lives in between.
Yeah, you review a life like that. This is a fantastic feature, but you know, for the rest of us, it might be a little bit more problematic.
Shots.
I think is the phrase.
This was my dinner. This is my dinner every day for.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, because of the popularity of TimeHop, which, I mean, I it's not something that I've used, and frankly, seeing people's TimeHops in my newsfeed makes
so
me
boring.
Want to, yeah, it makes me want to use Facebook even less than I already do now. But clearly there is some demand from some people out there to have this kind of feature. I don't know what TimeHop will think of Facebook basically taking its concept and just building it into its own.
I believe they said they welcome the challenge.
Oh.
Roll their sleeves up.
That's very good of them, but yeah.
I think they may be looking back on this time last year with a little bit of a brighter outlook. So they'll at least make use of their own products.
Yes, this is true. But and another thing that I noticed that people have been doing on Facebook recently, which is another quite annoying trend, is reposting their original profile pictures.
Oh, yeah.
And tagging lots of people in it and being like, hey, I've done mine, so now you should show me your original profile picture.
Public humiliation. The only people that do that are the ones that have really amazing first profile shots.
Yeah.
It does seem like something a charity might be able to latch onto, though, and raise £20 million, which would be a really good thing. But yeah.
There is no charity element to this.
That was so 2014.
Vanity, unfortunately.
Can't do that anymore.
But anyway, Facebook has also announced a few other things. So the first major thing that's going to make a difference to us using Facebook day to day is the new feature that it's introduced in its Messenger app. Now, this will allow you to start sending your friends content from sort of third-party apps, things like music, photos, videos, GIFs, and you can just kind of build this into your conversation. It's been introduced and it hasn't actually been rolled out yet, as far as I know, although Facebook has got already 40 partners on board, including an app called Ditty, which allows you to send custom musical messages to people over Messenger.
We're gonna all one day be like, how did we live without that?
It sounds fabulous.
And two apps called Giphy and Jibjab that allow you to send GIFs, which is, I think it's a bit like, this is like the death of emojis probably, because why would you send an emoji when you can send a GIF that is probably way funnier and way more expressive?
Now they're multicultural, just as they've opened it up.
Too late.
It's a little too late. Whatever, GIF.
But yeah, so this is part of its messenger rollout. And the reason that they've announced it at the developers conference is obviously because they want to get app developers on board and building apps and or introducing the feature into their own apps that will allow you to share all of this content more. So basically it's trying to take its messenger service to the next level and kind of elevate it above the standard,
to make it actually useful.
Yeah, and to make people want to use it more than, well, I suppose rivals like WhatsApp, which Facebook also owns.
But it's also, Facebook really just wants to be the plumbing for all of these important services in your life. And didn't they also announce some SDKs to be the back end for the Internet of Things?
Exactly.
Which is another horrifying idea that,
will run the world.
Well, it will absolutely run the world and already actually runs my house. Internet of Things lights and a Wi-Fi kettle and everything else. So,
yeah.
But yeah, Facebook just kind of wants to be the structure on which the rest of the world is built, right?
Yeah, that's right. It really seems to be going. I mean, this is an especially good time to look at this at the developers conference, when they're like basically announcing all of their infrastructure things, and you can really actually get a great insight into what their intentions are and how much they want to be a part of your life and what areas they're hoping to take over.
Do we find that disturbing or exciting?
Well, I think it's good business sense. I mean,
it is.
You know, Facebook doesn't know, you know, what the future of Facebook is going to be any more than we do, really. If you look more than sort of 5 or 10 years ahead, it may be that, you know, the most important conversations in our life are between our fridge and our kettle, and Facebook needs to be there to provide GIFs and, you know, a chat
along
mechanism for those things to talk to each other. But, you know, I think it's true that, you know, the reason they would buy Oculus Rift last year, or you know, buy WhatsApp and then build their own version, you know, is just they're making bets and they have enough money to do that. So you know, it makes a lot of sense to be the plumbing on which all of this stuff is built.
I suppose it's like investors who invest in a variety of different things. You know, they kind of spread their money around generally, and, you know, obviously some of those things will work out better than others. But yeah, you're right. Facebook can afford to take those kind of chances. The other thing that we're not totally sure about, but we have heard reports of, are that Facebook is kind of signing a deal with some major publishers like BuzzFeed, the New York Times, and I think there was another one, National Geographic, so that it will be hosting this content directly on Facebook itself. And the report, it does actually come from the New York Times, so is presumably fairly accurate. And what it will do is it will be sharing the revenue from the kind of the articles that are published with the publishers themselves.
But it's not, this isn't like original content. This is content that you'd find on the New York Times.
I think this is presumably.
I think it could be both.
It could be both, yeah.
I think publishers are increasingly building content which is specifically aimed at, if not hosted on Facebook anyway. And Facebook is prioritizing, you know, a lot of that original video and other content ahead of just normal status updates. So I think, you know, people are more comfortable now with the idea of making content that's primarily aimed at Facebook and not their own website. But, I think it is a dangerous move in some sense for publishers, because you're also giving up a lot of control, and you're also training, you know, your readers to not come to you for your content, to go to Facebook for it. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether that's a great model for making money, but also a great model for actually reading stuff and finding good stuff. So
I was going to say, that's a tricky balance. It would be interesting if it was different content, if you would go to New York Times, whatever, hub for Facebook hub for something different, something you're not going to find on their website. Otherwise, redundant.
I don't know. I think for younger readers especially, they increasingly, it doesn't seem like they really even know where they're reading a lot of stuff. They might be on the New York Times at one moment, and then they're going to be on the USA Today, or, you know, but they won't necessarily notice that they've switched websites. They're just looking at article pages and content. And Facebook drives such an enormous proportion of traffic to almost every publisher in the world.
Yeah.
It makes sense for those publishers to work as closely as they can with Facebook, and you don't, then maybe don't want to say no, but I think that there are some dangers there as well, and it kind of remains to be seen how effective this is going to be.
Yeah, I suppose from Facebook's point of view, it also makes sense that it wants some of the money from that, you know, that it is driving all this traffic to these new sites, and it would like some of the money back from that too. So, you know, and Facebook is one of those companies that's always looking for new ways to monetize. It's an interesting move. I'm not sure whether I'll enjoy it personally or what I'll make of it personally, but
well, and obviously we're waiting for the news, so we have to kind of remains to be seen exactly what the details are.
Yes, this is true.
But Michael, you were also talking when this came out. You were talking about Twitter's Periscope app, because
well, this just happened this morning.
Yeah, they've happened almost at the same time, and they're complete polar opposite.
Well, I mean, I think it's just that, you know, Periscope is a live streaming video app, and very similar to Meerkat, which has won a lot of attention over the last few weeks, particularly at South by Southwest. And the idea is that you can take out your phone, load up the app, and be live streaming video to an audience of dozens, probably, at best. I did a little experiment. I was broadcasting a shard of light that was on my desk, and I got seven viewers.
Oh, wow.
I was pretty pleased.
Yeah.
Sun
shines.
Yeah.
News.
It's a live video streaming app, a company bought by Twitter in January. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting. But I think that to your point, it is true that, you know, the amount of space that's left in our lives that could not conceivably be covered by social media is almost nil. I mean, you can, you know, live stream your life to, you know, the public, but also to your friends and family. Then you're on Facebook and looking at nostalgia and photos from years ago. And then you have an archive of Gmail. That's my personal favorite denizen of social media. Hell, in a way, because you can just search back over years and years and years of emails and see all the terrible things that you've ever kind of sent to people or said or regrets or whatever.
Wow.
I'm giving an insight
into
my soul.
You.
No, but I think it's true that, you know, there is an obsession with kind of the new in social media, and people are looking for new spaces to explore. And one of them is live video, and another is your past. But whether that's going to be a mainstream thing that, you know, regular people are going to want to pick up, I'm not sure yet.
There's no, like, let's just live normal lives in the kind of relative present.
There's no such thing as
immediate
normal.
Or nostalgic. No, but I mean, we're not replicating our experiences of life. We're putting them into these strange nuggets that are either nostalgic, showing off, or instant, you know, balls of light on your desk that are super, super thrilling.
I think it's probably true that there are people out there who are going to find a career with Periscope or Meerkat or some of these apps. They're going to, you know, it does open up some interesting possibilities for new kinds of content and new kinds of personalities. But again, whether that turns into a mainstream thing or just something that is more similar to a Vine celebrity who's incredibly popular with his audience. But
didn't one Vine celebrity get kind of screwed over quite recently when all of his vines were deleted by a hacker or something like that?
Really?
I think I'm sure I heard something like that. So maybe, you know, if you're live streaming and your celebrity relies on live streams, then you don't have that risk.
No,
I suppose
you're just a transient being.
But, you know, Periscope,
like celebrity.
Periscope is new, so if you want to, you know, make a career for yourself on the web, go now, quickly. Find your audience.
And Facebook's conference is ongoing, so it's entirely possible that they are working feverishly now in California to get their own version, and it will be announced later today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if it is, then we called it here first.
That's all for today. Just one piece of feedback. Katie Philippa Hornsby wrote in to talk about your wonderful biometric banking piece.
That's right. Philippa says, "Hi, podcast team. I was listening to your most recent episode on Halifax's biometric banking plans, and I'm wondering why we take such stringent security measures online for banking, but not in branch. To my knowledge, my bank knows my name and address, but only needs my signature to take money out in person. This has caused me all sorts of grief, as my passport and driver's license are a few years old, and with the advent of chip and PIN, I never have to sign for anything. I also happen to have appalling handwriting, so my signature changes day to day. This gives me all sorts of problems when I go to the bank and literally none of my signatures match. So my question is, why do banks not use biometric data to access your accounts in branch as well as online? Surely your data is just as safe there as anywhere, and we already use it for passports and even some casinos.
Casinos? So maybe we trust casino employees more than banking employees. I'm not sure what the answer is, Philippa.
I think that it reminds me of some technology that I saw at Mobile World Congress, actually, which is a kind of biometric signature tech. And I know you said, Philippa, that your signature changes day to day, but this looks at more than just the actual outline of your signature. It measures all sorts of things, like the pressure of your handwriting and the speed, and to come up with a match. And it's found to be fairly accurate. So perhaps we could start to improve the in-branch security with that kind of technology at first.
Or go with the one that measures your gait, and as you walk in the door, it already knows who you are, and someone just walks up to you and hands you 50 quid.
I think it's true, though, that with bank security, all of that interesting stuff is usually just layered on top of 50 years of archaic procedure. I signed up for a new bank account recently and had to fax my personal details, which were lost five times. I won't name the bank. But
fax?
Yeah, and it was disturbing. So, like, you know, I think banks are essentially Gringotts underneath it all. It's just caves and dragons and gold in piles.
And they're looking up at us going, biometric, you're lucky we don't eat you.
On the top, they have a chip and pin, but otherwise it's 50 feet of dragons. So.
Well, there you go, Philippa. You heard it here. Dragons is really the answer to your problem, I'm afraid, and we can't do anything about that. But, you know, please keep writing in. Well, that's all from us this week, but Michael, it's been very fun to have your first podcast.
It's been great to be here. Hopefully I'll last long enough to be back next week, unless the reaction is so overwhelmingly awful that I'm banished forever.
It couldn't possibly
please
write
nice.
In and don't critique us. No, yeah.
Or welcome
gentle.
Michael, send some nice welcome messages.
I'm on Twitter at Michael Rundle, so you can always say hello there.
Cue love mail. Anyway, see you all next week. Bye.
Bye.